Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where performance is driven by original fundamental research on a global scale. This is Putnam Today. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Remember way back to those days when you were a kid and the announcement of no summer break would have been devastating? In these hard times, this news is actually encouraging. Most General Motors plants will stay open all summer. Not that we're questioning that. We're just wondering, how'd that happen? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reputation Defender, monitoring, protecting, and helping improve your online reputation while deleting personal data from websites that sell it. ReputationDefender.com/market. And by Progressive Insurance, helping people shop for car insurance at 1-800-PROGRESSIVE and progressive.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios and the home of the champion L.A. Lakers, I'm Bob Moon, in for Kai Rizdahl. Thanks very much for making us a part of your Friday, this 18th day of June. It's been less than a year since GM emerged from bankruptcy, but it seems Chapter 11 agreed with the carmaker. Demand for its cars is now so high, the company's skipping the annual summer shutdown at most of its U.S. assembly plants. Not only that, GM says it has the cash to finance an Opel revamp. And domestic cars are doing better than their imported rivals on the J.D. Power quality rankings. It's the first time that's happened in the survey's 24-year history. We asked Marketplace's Elisa Roth to find out, what's Detroit putting in its breakfast cereal?
GM has to keep its plants running all summer because people finally want to buy its cars. That demand, along with its lean, new post-bankruptcy operations, is helping the company make more money, which is why it doesn't need to borrow money to revamp its European division, Opel. Michael Robinetz, an analyst at IHS Automotive, he says GM's finally achieving what used to seem like an impossible goal.
The moons are aligning at General Motors with respect to the fact that the product is much better and really being looked at by the consumer in a very positive light.
One of the things GM did to restructure itself was to get rid of a lot of brands. So now there are only four: Buick, Cadillac, Chevrolet, and GMC. Steve Witten is in charge of U.S. auto research at J.D. Power. Its quality survey measures how reliable vehicles are right off the line. Witten says not all GM cars did brilliantly in the study, but it's clear that these days the company is paying more attention to the details.
Down at the plant level, that's where quality starts, is they're really able to focus on their most important brands and their most important models. And we're starting to see the effect of that in this study.
Domestic car makers did better than the foreign transplants this year, partly because Toyota did so badly. But Witten says he thinks the quality of American vehicles will keep getting better. I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
Old habits die hard in Washington. Every few years, or sometimes less, the government tries to bring down health care costs by reducing Medicare payments to doctors. Then, usually at the last minute, Congress votes to hold the cuts off until another time. That happened again today. The Senate passed a bill that temporarily spares doctors from a 21% cut in Medicare payments. The House will take up the bill next week, which raises the question, once again, how do you lower Medicare costs without paying doctors less? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer reports.
The formula Medicare uses to pay doctors sets annual limits on doctor fees with automatic cuts. But Congress can override those cuts, and it has for almost a decade, usually right before the cuts are to take effect. It was so close this time, the American Medical Association launched a multi-million dollar ad campaign to prod Congress.
Tell your senators to get back to work and fix Medicare now.
This game of chicken has become too much for some doctors. They've stopped taking Medicare patients, or worse.
We won't quit taking Medicare patients. We'll just close up.
Dave Davis is an ophthalmologist in Albany, Georgia. The doctors in his practice are considering retirement. He's moving to Arkansas, where overhead is lower. Dr. Cecil Wilson is head of the American Medical Association.
Congress basically is playing Russian roulette with the care and the health of America's seniors. Physicians are irritated and frustrated.
And health care costs keep going up. The health care reform law attempts to tackle that problem by changing how doctors are paid. Len Nichols is a health care economist at George Mason University.
The key to making our Medicare program solvent is to change the way we pay, to structure incentives in such a way that it is in providers' interest to to deliver value, not volume.
Right now, the more services doctors provide, the more they get paid. Nichols says the health care reform law tries to change that by giving doctors part of the savings if they reduce unnecessary tests and procedures. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Wall Street rode the seesaw down and up, and finished on the upside today by a small fraction. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. It's Friday, and you know what that means. It's time for the weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond. Joining us this week are Heidi Moore from The Big Money. Hello, Heidi.
Hi, Bob.
And Visible Economy's Mike Mandel. Hi, Mike.
Great to be here.
Good to talk to you both again. Once again, it's been the consuming news all week, so let's start with BP. We learned today that BP's CEO, Tony Hayward, is handing over the reins on his company's recovery efforts in the Gulf and letting his manager take care of that now. I wonder, do you think that decision had anything to do with the image that he promoted before Congress yesterday, by his own words, so seemingly disconnected from this disastrous drilling operation? Is this the company's CEO trying to distance himself even more, do you think, Heidi, or is that even possible after yesterday's testimony?
I think he was probably functioning on some very strict advice from his lawyers, because his stonewalling was of the most masterful type. I mean, not one bit of information was going to escape his lips. Darn it. He was absolutely positive of that. So I think that he probably realized that there had been, or there will be, legal implications to what's going on there. And unfortunately, a lot of what he said was not very plausible in terms of, you know, the fact that he was so out of the loop with these decisions. I mean, at some point, he must have been briefed on them.
Then we had that apology to BP that Republican Joe Barton has tried to take back now, suggesting the White House engaged in a $20 billion shakedown to push BP into setting aside money for victims. Well, today, I read the New York Times, and they run a story about how the president has been strong-arming big business since he took office. What about it? Was this really a shakedown, Mike?
If you look at the big picture, what's been happening is that Obama has been pretty hard on the communications industry, on the pharma industry, on healthcare, on the auto industry, on the oil industry, but he's been easier on the financial sector.
Is this something Mr. Obama is going to be known for, playing tough with big business, Heidi?
I think definitely. And he came in with that expectation. And he came in during a time of unprecedented crisis, or unprecedented recession, at least, in the American economy. And everything that's happened since then has been a kind of through-the-looking-glass world in the markets. The finance system is not functioning the way that it once did. All of our companies were questioning the premises of the way that they work and how they do businesses, from healthcare to oil. And so he will be remembered for that, whether or not he wants to be.
But he just hasn't been that tough with big finance. I mean, I'm a little bit hesitant to sort of say, when you say big business, you're lumping everybody together. And when you look at the financial reform bill and you look at the way that the big financial companies have come out of this mess that they created, I don't know if you can say that he's really been tough on them, right? So it's almost industry by industry.
Well, there's also the issue of cutting off your nose to spite your face. I mean, there's only so tough you can be with the financial industry without throwing the markets into another tailspin. We're still in a very tenuous time.
Well, Mike, let's pick up on your concerns and switch gears to financial reform. We should see something in the next couple of weeks from Capitol Hill, but I've got to know, what do you think? Is this shaping up as just a way for politicians to protect their own interests?
What's been happening is that the bill has been steadily weakened. And in terms of hitting directly at the large financial institutions, it doesn't seem to be doing the job. Our industrial companies have been hit hard by the downturn. Financial companies have benefited from cheap money from the government. And so this was the big chance to sort of rectify the balance, and it doesn't look like it's happening.
Heidi, what do you think? If it ends up being relatively toothless, what is that going to leave us with?
All we really want to do is bring back the old Glass-Steagall Act that separated risk-taking in banks, right? Things that are risky in the markets have to do with, you know, derivatives and swaps and all of that, and separate that from commercial banking, where banks lend out to companies and to people. So the question of whether this will be effective is the question of whether anyone will really be able to read through all 3,200 pages of legislation and actually make something useful of it.
Visible Economy's Mike Mandel and Heidi Moore from The Big Money, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
At the risk of sounding like a movie ad, Toy Story 3 is now playing at a theater near you. The much-anticipated animated sequel doesn't need my help, though. It's already expected to bring in more than $70 million this weekend. If you can't get tickets to that, there's always Shrek 4 or Sex and the City 2. Notice a trend here, and it hasn't turned out to be a good one when it comes to box office numbers. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek-Smith takes a look at why the lineup at your local theater is looking like one big movie flashback.
We're getting thrown away!
No one's getting thrown away!
Actually, everybody's getting recycled. Media analyst Porter Bibb says sequels are safe, and with movie studios trying to adjust to competition from the internet, video games, and cell phones, safe looks pretty good.
Most sequels do extremely well, and they don't have to reinvent the wheel. They've got the package, they've got the storylines, and the talent all lined up.
And there are other perks.
What are you going to do with these old toys?
Dust them off and sell them. Bibb says movie studios used to make 80% of their money off the actual movie. Now, toys, video games, and other products can bring in more than half of the revenue for a big franchise.
You don't have any dead inventory. You can keep those toys and characters out there for many, many years.
We called it sequelitis.
Entertainment analyst Hal Vogel says movie studios shouldn't overdo sequels. For one thing, the quality of the movies tends to go down.
What happened to you?
I may have let myself go a little.
And Vogel says sequels rarely do as well as the original.
The problem with it, besides burning out the audience interest, is that your costs tend to go up.
Stars and locations get more expensive, and Vogel says a bad movie can damage the whole brand.
My dear friends, we have come to the final chapter.
Or not. Analyst Porter Bibb says even if the sequel flops, the products often keep selling.
Come on, let's see how much we're going for on eBay.
In Los Angeles, I'm Stacey Vanek-Smith for Marketplace.
Coming up, when age and experience aren't necessarily a plus.
We find that a lot of the older, really experienced, really educated people have to dumb down.
A look at the midlife job crisis. But first, let's do the numbers. Wall Street ended the day and the week in the money. The Dow Jones Industrial Average pushed up a tenth of 1% today, 16 points, to close at 10,450. The Nasdaq hiked a tenth of 1% too. That's a gain of 2 points to close at 2309. The S&P 500 also rose a tenth of a percent, ending a point higher at 1117. For the week, the Dow and the S&P 500 closed up 2.4%, and the Nasdaq finished up 3%. Drugstore chains CVS and Walgreens popped up today on news the companies have announced a resolution to their spat over pharmacy benefit management. CVS rolled up 1.8%, and Walgreens rang up 2.8%. Bonds fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.22%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk. Since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. And by Vanguard, a client-owned company where the clients own the funds and the funds own the company. Learn more at vanguard.com. Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune in to Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
On the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Monday. So, the Lakers won. If your commute takes you into downtown Los Angeles, consider riding the bus or your bike. The NBA champs are anticipating 500,000 to 2 million fans for a celebratory parade. Sorry that basketball is wrapped. There's tennis. Wimbledon begins. Attendees are advised to leave vuvuzelas or other noisemakers at home as a condition of entry to the All England Lawn Tennis and Croquet Club. Shh. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Bob Moon in for Kai Ryssdal. Here are some numbers we didn't get to a moment ago from today's World Cup. United States 2, Slovenia 2. For now, that keeps hopes alive for the Americans, but the tie also leaves the team at risk of not advancing in the South African Games. If you want to know the real global score, though, keep your eye on the billboards circling the field. Marketplace's Rob Schmitz noticed something new in between the Adidas and McDonald's signs, the World Cup's first Chinese sponsor.
The ad is for Yingli, China's giant solar panel manufacturer. The company is China's first to become a global sponsor of the World Cup. Yingli spent at least $100 million so that its name will appear on TV for about 8 minutes each game during the month-long event. They're targeting European countries that offer big subsidies for solar panels, but they're also positioning themselves for a growing Chinese market. The global PR firm Ogilvy handled the Yingli account. Ogilvy's Scott Cronick says it's all part of trying to promote Chinese companies as a global brand.
And you're going to see not only Chinese companies trying to build a global presence and using sports sponsorships to do so, but you'll see them kind of using global sports sponsorships as a prestige value to communicate back into China.
And says Chronic, you're already starting to see well-known Western brands using the world stage to show off their names in Chinese. This spring, English Premier League players wore jerseys emblazoned with the Chinese characters for Danish beer maker Carlsberg. At least someone in the world can afford to buy imported beer these days. I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
I'd wager that Dennis Hopper, rest his soul, never could have imagined this when he was directing Easy Rider back in 1969, a motorcycle rally officially named for a big corporate sponsor. Perhaps you've heard of Laconia Bike Week. It's the oldest of the country's big three motorcycle rallies, and the event in New Hampshire used to be one of the wildest. But as Shannon Mullen reports, these days it's part of a different scene.
It's been a while since J.R. Wedland came to the Laconia Motorcycle Rally.
15 years ago, I said.
You came 15 years ago.
Yeah.
What was it like back then?
I don't know. I was young and drunk all week.
Wedland rode in all the way from Wisconsin. He says this year, Bike Week seems tamer.
I like the olden days. When we used to drink a six-pack going down the road, you know. Of course, I'm older too, maybe. That's why. But I mean, I'm slowing down.
There's a lot more gray hair and big guts at Bike Week these days. In fact, the American Motorcyclists Association says aging baby boomers are now the largest demographic of bikers. But you might still be surprised by the rally's main sponsor. It's not a beer or motorcycle company. It's Progressive Insurance. Rally organizer Jennifer Anderson says that's not as ironic as it sounds.
It's not necessarily like in the way that you might be thinking about insurance. It's just like, hey, you love this, take care of it. And if something happens, you know that we have your back.
At the Laconia Harley-Davidson dealer, a crowd cheers on Steve Boucher and his wife, Lisa. The Connecticut couple just bought a brand new bright blue Harley Ultra Classic.
It was spur of the moment. Life's too short, so we might as well just live large.
But before he can drive the bike off the lot, he needs insurance. No problem. Progressive agent Leslie K. Drury has a desk on the showroom floor.
I don't think it's a sign of things going soft. I think it's a sign of insurance companies becoming more aware that they need to be there for their demographic.
Drury is a Harley owner herself. She says she's selling several policies a day here.
If you can't get in front of somebody, meet them, make a connection with them, share their interests, their values, and their hobbies, you really can't provide them the service that they need.
Rally organizers say having Progressive for a title sponsor means more money for marketing the event year-round. That's key because attendance has been down for years. Younger bikers still show off their bikes and link up with other riders. They're just doing it online now. Throw in a recession, and the result? Smaller crowds at the big rallies in Florida, South Dakota, and New Hampshire. Laconia is the first of the big three to get a corporate title sponsor. Progressive won't say whether it's courting the other two. In Laconia, New Hampshire, I'm Shannon Mullen for Marketplace.
When it comes to the job losses Americans are suffering through, it's been said that this has been very much a middle-class recession. That's because it's hit broadly, from manufacturing to real estate to finance, taking down many more mid-career professionals than a typical downturn. And many of those workers may never catch up to the career level they'd reached before. In this installment of our series, Help Not Wanted, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman travels to Chicago to see how the recovery we've been hearing about is panning out for one worker who has to start over.
Imagine, you're pushing 60, nice house, money in the bank, no plans to retire. Then, after decades in corporate management, there's a shakeup and you're out the door. But you can still pick up consulting gigs and bring in some income. That's where Steve Kern found himself when he pulled this message out of a fortune cookie a few years ago. He thought it was funny, so he framed it.
You'll earn thousands of dollars daily by doing nothing.
And you were unemployed for 2 years. Did you find that to be true?
No. Alas, it was terrible. No, it was actually really a very distressing time.
At a downtown job center run by the Chicago Federation of Labor, the caseworkers have seen a lot of mid-career professionals like Kern grappling with these distressing times.
I will never forget the first time one of my clients got a job. It was like I was getting a job. Jumping up and down, hugs.
Mara Sutman has a caseload of about 50 people from construction, healthcare, high tech, and finance. She says many of them spent 20 years at the same company, or at least in the same field, moving steadily up the organizational chart.
When they first come to us, we sit down with them and say, you know, listen, it's an employer's market. People have to take wage cuts. So.
We find that a lot of the older, really experienced, really educated people have to dumb down.
Caseworker Ellen Kilmer.
They've done all that work, they've done all that education, and now they have to pretend like they don't have a master's degree because some people don't want to hire that advanced of people because it's expensive.
And that's how you get people like Steve Kern struggling to make ends meet. They've earned senior-level salaries, saved and invested. Now, late in their careers, they're burning through it all. Kern shows me around his spread in the suburb of Barrington. He's surrounded by horse farms and developments with names like Oaksbury and Timberlake Estates.
See those evergreen trees? Those evergreen trees are the back of my yard. These are all minimum 2-acre lots, good-sized houses. Not quite McMansions, but there are a bunch.
Kern's lived in one of these not-quite McMansions with his wife and chronically ill daughter for nearly 2 decades. They moved in after he became a human resources VP at Sears. He's been job hunting for more than 2 years. There'll be interest, but then...
When people figure out how old you are, things go away. People get less interviews, less follow-ups, and so forth. We've gained all this information and this experience and are not really old in a mental or physical sense and really want to do something, and I don't know what to do with that.
Meanwhile, Kern and his wife have been running through their savings.
But then we start dipping into the savings where you're taking the 10% penalty for early withdrawal just to get some money to pay the mortgage. And you're keeping up appearances. And
here's what Kern's found out about appearances.
I was walking the dog and ran into a neighbor. Standing on one corner, they pointed at no fewer than 6 or 7 houses where they said, oh yeah, this couple here, both of them lost their jobs. This guy lost his job. She lost her job. And I was completely unaware of it.
As of today, Steve Kern is no longer one of these jobless suburbanites. He's on the road to Gainesville to run a management training program at the University of Florida, where he'll be talking to young people about the tough job market they face. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
There's a lot more to this story, and our sister program, Marketplace Money, is traveling to WBEZ in Chicago this weekend to find out what people there are doing to look for work. Like Sherry McClendon, after 34 years of continuous employment, she'll work anywhere. Walmart, McDonald's, you name it.
I never thought I would say that 10 years ago. Probably would have turned my nose up, but how humble we get. How very humble we get.
Check out our website for tons of info on our Chicago special this weekend, marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Elance, where businesses can connect with programmers, designers, marketers, and other independent professionals to get jobs done. You can build a team online at elance.com. And by Putnam Investments, offering long-term strategies built on experience and research. On the web at putnam.com/largecapequity. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note on the way out today to catch us up on the things that didn't make the headlines, courtesy of Brendan Noonan and the rest of the Marketplace staff.
Ben Adair, Editorial Director for Sustainability at Marketplace. What's your story this weekend?
A city in northeastern Japan called Isesaki, I think it's called, has come out with a brilliant new effort to fight climate change. They've banned beards.
How is this supposed to prevent climate change?
Apparently it's part of a whole campaign they have there called Cool Biz. They're trying to get companies to run their air conditioning less. And now because beards make people so hot, no more beards.
Wait, does this mean the North Pole's melting because of Santa Claus? Stacey Vanek-Smith, senior reporter for Marketplace, what's your story?
A tanning tax is going into effect on July 1st.
Once again, New Jersey is going to carry an inordinate amount of this nation's tax load.
I know. Well, apparently, tanning booths are as bad for you as smoking, and they think that this could bring in more than $2.5 billion.
I heard they tried this in England, and it brought in no revenue at all.
No.
Nihar Patel, fill-in producer for Marketplace. What's your story this weekend?
I love this one. IBM has designed a supercomputer, and they're calling it Watson, and they hope it'll be able to compete and win on Jeopardy this fall.
So my response comes in the form of a question.
Naturally.
Why are the greatest minds of our generation spending time figuring out how to compete on Jeopardy?
Correct.
Thanks, Alex.
But, you know, the funny thing about this is what happens when Watson goes insane, gets every question wrong, and starts trying to shave off Alex Trebek's mustache?
There's more like that on the Dinner Party Download. That's the podcast Brendan does with co-host Rico Galliano. Rico, by the way, will be back on the Dinner Party circuit after his honeymoon. Meantime, there's a link to what Brendan's put together on our website, marketplace.org. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow pushed up 16 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ hiked 0.1%, too. That's a gain of 2 points. The S&P 500 also rose 0.1%, ending a point higher than it started. Our theme music was composed by B.J. Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Celeste Wesson. The executive producer is J.J. Yor. Remember to tune in this weekend to our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, as we broadcast from Chicago. I'm Bob Moon. Hope you can join Kai back here on Monday.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.